2005. The first item on the agenda will be SB 5507. I will open a hearing on 5507, the Oregon Board of Dentistry. We, committee members, we are now in phase two, but in regards to those budgets that we will have up on Mondays in this committee, we will be in phase one and phase two every Monday. Ms. Mathey, who I'm not pronouncing your name probably correctly.
Yes, correct. You are.
Okay. Ms. Mathey is the analyst for all the health licensing commissions and some of the other smaller agencies that we have also. And so she'll give you a brief explanation of the process we'll be going through. Normally, we will only have about 45 minutes per entity that's before us on a Monday, and then we'll come back.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. What we'll do is the agency will start, run through their phase one presentation, similar information that you've been getting to date. They'll then turn it over to the DAS budget analyst, and she will go through the governor's budget from her perspective, and then to toss it back to the agency, they will go through the budget detail, the real phase two portion of the presentation. In each of your binders, hopefully I now have the correct ones at your places, you'll have a copy of the DAS analyst presentation as well as the agency's presentation material should be attached to the yellow covered memos that I distributed last week.
Okay. With that, we will bring up maybe we could bring them up two at a time. The executive director, Mr. Brantz, and the Mr. Nichols, the vice president of the Board of Dentistry. Please proceed and identify yourself for the record.
Good morning. Thank you, Chair Devlin. My name is Patrick Brotz, and I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Board of Dentistry. With me today here is Dr. Rodney Nichols, who is the Board's new Vice President of the Board. And I thank you for the opportunity to appear here today on our budget. A little overview of the Board of Dentistry. The Board of Dentistry was established in 1887. It's the second oldest licensing board in the state of Oregon. The practice of dental hygiene was added to the board in 1946 as a regulated profession. The mission of the Board of Dentistry is to ensure that the citizens of the state receive the highest possible quality of dental care. The board's identified goal is to protect the public from unsafe, incompetent, and fraudulent practitioners, to encourage licensees to practice safely and to competently in the best interest of their patients, and also to educate the public on acceptable and appropriate dental practices. All of this is outlined in the Oregon statutes. There are 9 members on the board. There are 7 permanent full-time staff. I have in the handout for you an appendix, the organizational chart, which is item A, which you can review at your leisure, that shows the breakdown. The 9 board members include 6 dentists, one of which must be a specialist by law, 2 dental hygienists, and 1 public board member. And members, as you are, I'm sure, aware, are appointed by the governor and confirmed by the Senate for 4-year terms. The board meets approximately every 8 weeks to conduct its business. Communications and consumer protection are the board's highest priorities, and this is reflected in the board's performance measures, which I'll discuss a little bit later in the presentation. The board does utilize a number of contracted dental consultants, and which provide expertise, as well as some dental specialists that assist us in conducting specialty examinations in the state of Oregon. The board has 5 working committees that assist it, and by that I mean they're not just committees of the board. They have individuals appointed from various other organizations. They are the Dental Hygiene Committee, the Communications Committee, Enforcement and Discipline, Licensing Standards and Competency, and Rule Oversight. The board enjoys a very good working relationship with the dental school, as well as the Oregon Dental Association, the Oregon Dental Hygienists Association, and the Oregon Dental Assistants Association. One of the board's primary goals, at least since I came on board, and I should highlight for you that I'm told I have a little bit of an accent because I'm not from Oregon originally. I'm from Wisconsin, so I apologize for that.
Just call it Oregon.
No, I learned that very quickly because there is a place in Wisconsin that pronounces it that way.
Mr. Chair,
yes,
I have to apologize, too. I'm from North Carolina.
Yeah, I know. We won't get into that. One of the board's primary goals is to improve access to good oral oral health care for Oregonians, and recently the board developed a new volunteer dentist dental hygienist licensee category to encourage retired practitioners to offer their services at no cost in exchange for a special license that requires no license renewal fee. And I'm happy to say that we already have one person who has signed up for that license and have about two or three more applications in the wings. The board is also active participants on licensing at the national and regional level. Two members of the board, one dentist, one hygienist member, are, and the board executive director, are members of the American Association of Dental Examiners, as well as I'm a member of the American Association of Dental Administrators. One member of the board also sits on the Western Regional Examining Board, which is referred to as REB, which conducts the examinations in about 30 states in the United States. The board is funded by other funds, primarily by licensees, and for budget purposes, the board is one operational unit. Our major activities are licensing and examination, enforcement and compliance, and administration. As of today, there are currently about 3,500 licensed dentists and 3,200 licensed dental hygienists. We anticipate issuing about 650 new licenses in the upcoming biennium, almost equally divided between dentists and dental hygienists. However, this increase does not translate into a lot more practitioners because of retirements, licenses that are allowed to lapse, and any number of reasons why practitioners are moving out of the state. This isn't just a dramatic increase. I guess I just want to summarize a little bit of the board's services and our major budgetary issues. Licensing and examination, we do have eight specialty examinations that the board does give on occasion when individuals qualify for those specialty exams. Otherwise, the board accepts the Western Regional Boards and the Central Regional Dental Testing Examination. And I should make the committee aware that there is in the process a new national licensing examination that is probably going to roll out this August. As you know, the profession of dentistry, or maybe you don't know, is one of the last professions that there is not a national examination. Medicine, physical therapy, veterinary all have national examinations, and so dentistry is going to roll out a new national examination. And the board is obviously working with that and trying to find out what we'll need to do to be a part of that. Our enforcement and monitoring, the board, as you know, conducts investigations of complaints filed with the board. The board is obligated by law to investigate every complaint that comes before it. The board is not obligated to discipline everyone that comes before them, obviously. We have complaints coming from individuals. We have complaints where the board has initiated them. We have complaints that come from as a result of information we receive from other state boards, from malpractice carriers, as well as the National Practitioner Data Bank. There are usually about 45 to 50 people we have monitoring at any one time, that the board is monitoring these individuals, that they've signed a consent order saying they will do certain things. During 2004, the board closed about 250 investigations, and the disposition of those cases is as follows. We dismissed about 155 cases. Letters of concern were issued in 76 cases. Those are non-disciplinary items. Those are more of educational tools and reminding people of some things that may have happened, and so that it doesn't rise to the level of discipline. And we took approximately 31 disciplinary actions. Of those disciplinary actions, we had one voluntary resignation, three suspensions, three restrictions, 18 reprimands. There were 11 civil penalties or restitution, nine orders dealt with education and training, and three orders dealt with evaluation and treatment monitoring. I should also at this time point out that the board started in this fall a pilot diversion program, a confidential diversion program, which some other boards currently have in statute. We reviewed with our legal counsel and found out that we felt that we could try this pilot project without having to seek statutory authority, without having to increase our budget, and so we have done so, and I would report today that we have approximately seven individuals now in this pilot diversion program, so the board will review it actually at 1 year, but so far it appears to be very successful. The administration activities of the board obviously are in the area of communication and keeping the office flowing. One of my goals as I came on here was to try to do an outreach program, and so we've done a lot of speaking to a variety of groups, not only in the profession, but some consumer groups, trying to tell them what the Board of Dentistry is about and how we do things and seeking their input. And so far it's been very successful. I think that's an important part that we not just be unknown. I know that one of the issues that you're focusing on are performance measures, and so I want to just review for you briefly. It's in the report, specifically our performance measures. The performance measures for 2004 were percent of licensees in compliance with the continuing education requirements. The goal for 2004 was 98% in compliance. We do audit 15%. I'm sorry.
Excuse me for a moment. It's on page 9.
I'm sorry. Yes. Okay. Our goal was 98%. Our performance was 97% are currently in compliance or at the time when we prepared the progress report. 3% were found not to be in compliance, and so we are in the process of investigating why they are not in compliance and attempting to seek compliance. The second performance measure was the average time from the receipt of a new complaint to when that complaint is completely investigated and is prepared to the board so that the board can decide what they want to do. Our goal was 5 months. During the time period of 7/1/2003 through 6/30/2004, our actual time was 2.9 months. The average number of working days for receipt of completed paperwork to the issuance of a license, that's either a brand new license or renewal, our goal was 9 days, and we established 8 days. Percent of users, we have a website, and we know we get a lot of hits to the website because we review our reports. We had hoped that we have a little survey on there, and we had hoped that we would have a 90% positive with that survey. Unfortunately, we only had a 45% positive, but then only 12 people bothered to fill out the survey, so it's a little very small number, even though we probably get somewhere between 500 and 1,000 hits a week onto the site. I guess people just are going there for information and not wanting to fill out a survey. And finally, our last performance measure is that the board annually reviews the rules and regulations that are there to make sure that they are effective and if they need to be changed. That committee met in January 9 of 2004 and have made some substantial changes to the board's rules and will again review those rules.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In relationship to only 12 people filling out the survey, what plans, if any, are underway or being contemplated to somehow or another get better feed or more feedback from the public on this?
We're going to look at changing the survey, and I think it may not be as user-friendly to the individuals, and I need to sit down with our IT people, and we had to make a major change from our website to the state's current eGov site, and so we spent a lot of time doing that and didn't really review the survey, so I think I need to sit down and look at the survey and find if there are more opportunities while people are seeking information that they can respond to the survey, and there may be some questions on the survey that simply people don't want to answer, so they don't bother to participate in the survey.
Mr. Chair, follow up.
Yes, Representative Jensen.
I understand there may be some costs involved in this, but have you contemplated any kind of a random phone survey with some of the some people?
No, we haven't. We've thought about doing a survey with some of our licensees, the new licensees, to see if the process that they go through is an appropriate process. We could look at that. That's something that we could take under advisement. I had not thought of that. It's a good suggestion.
Thank you. Another clarification. Sure. On the website, is it primarily intended for licensees, or is it intended for the general public, or both?
A little bit of both. It's probably weighted a little bit toward the licensees, but we are looking at, there are a number of frequently asked questions on there that can be done. Our complaint forms are on there. We are looking at actually putting the disciplinary information on the website. Right now there's a license lookup. You can check and see if someone does have a license, but if you want further information, you have to contact the board. The board has voted to put the actual consent orders of those individuals that were disciplined on that site, and so we are in the process of doing that. It just making the conversion to eGov took a lot of time, and so now that that's up and running, we're going to look at doing that. So I would say it somewhat is to licensees, but yes, consumers still can find information about us and download the complaint form. They can send us emails from there, and we do get them with complaints.
Please proceed.
Thank you. The board does have in place a strategic business plan that they adopted. A 6-year plan for the agency assures that licensees are qualified and competent to practice safely, promoting access to oral health care. Standards of practice and statutes and regulations will be realistic and understandable, and the board will communicate timely and useful information regarding the board's mission, its services, policies, and standard practices of the public and licensees. You'll find the board's strategic plan actually in the governor's recommended budget book starting on page 21. I want to just just highlight a couple of the major accomplishments that took place in this biennium. As I stated earlier, the board did create a pilot confidential diversion program in 2004. In 2004, the board also adopted a mentoring program that can be used as a part of the disciplinary process. Many times when complaints will come into the board, it'll be that someone is lacking a certain type of education or a certain type of issue. And so instead of simply saying this person should never practice again, the board wants to see that this person will get some continuing education. And that sounds real easy. Well, let's just go back to school. Well, that doesn't work sometimes. And so we've worked with the American General Dentistry Academy to put together a mentoring program where we can have these individuals be mentored and find out their deficiencies and have those deficiencies be corrected. And again, we started this process in September. And again, we did it without budgetary issues. And then in 2005, the board created its volunteer dentist and dental hygienist license status. And we're really looking forward to that program. Basically, this budget is a budget that pretty much maintains the level of the Board of Dentistry. There are no policy packages in this budget. I want to highlight just one other area, the board's affirmative action report. Again, before I was here, but Senate Bill 276 created a cultural diversity issue before the board, and so in 2002, the board participated with the Oregon Health Workforce Project conducted by OHSU to determine demographics for our profession. This is on page 12. Of 16. And as a result of that, starting in January of 2002, the board surveyed all the renewals for our professionals, asking them certain information, and about 3,400 of those individuals responded, and you see the results of regarding the language issue in this report. We also put this into our new licensee packets as well, so we're getting information from the new licensees as well as our continuing licensees. So that's sort of a little bit of an overview of the Board of Dentistry. Dr. Nichols, if he'd like to add anything, he's been on the board for about 3 years, am I correct? 2 years. So I'll let him just if he wants to make a few comments.
Dr. Nichols, if you would identify yourself for the record.
Dr. Rodney Nichols, practicing dentist in the state of Oregon and board member. I appreciate the opportunity to be here. I don't have prepared comments. I will echo what Mr. Bratz has said. We have made progress in a number of areas. First of all, we're pleased with the organizational and administrative skills of our new administrator, who has come to us recently, as you know, now from Wisconsin. Our pilot program in our pilot diversion program is a very successful item. It brings forth those individuals who may have previously been disciplined, but allows us to help them and help them into recovery while maintaining their good dental skills. The program for allowing mentoring is important. Many times individuals may have education but not experience, and this mentoring program helps them gain experience and judgment under the supervision of a very well qualified dentist. Thank you.
Representative Marsh, then Representative Wisnant.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I noticed that in your testimony you mentioned that there's going to be a new national exam that comes out this fall, and that currently 26% of your program activity is spent doing licensing and examinations. Do you anticipate a reduction in that function since you're going to be relying more on a national exam?
Mr. Chairman, Representative March, no. Actually, what it is it's just another way. We don't actually physically give the exam. This is the processing of all those results that come in. So it'll just be another entity. So I don't anticipate a reduction. Actually, there's a number of bills before the legislature which could increase opportunities for individuals to get a license in this state. And so there may even be a little bit of an increase in workload, but I don't feel that it's going to be a problem for us within this budget.
Thank you.
Representative Wisnant.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Bruns, could you have several questions? I'll go through them. Why are there no dental assistants on the board? Has that been discussed? Second, for my own information, because I have a request for volunteer doctors to be licensed, be accepted, is there a bill that authorizes your dentist to do volunteer work without doing the license? The third thing is looking at your operation, and could you explain more? You give your organizational chart, and you have investigators, consultants, and are they on a blanket contract? And because you said you only had one dentist, so I'm assuming these investigators are not dentists. And how do you do that? How does that operation work? And third or fourth, I thought in your reduction, your proposed reductions for the 10%, why we couldn't go ahead and eliminate unsolicited copies, whether it's we have to cut it or not. Looks like that'd be an efficiency for your operation. Thank you.
I'll try to see if I can remember all of those. I'll go to the investigator ones first. We do have two investigators that are retired dentists that are on contract with us, and they have a contract for a certain period of hours, a certain period of time. The other two full-time investigators that we have are not dentists. They come from a background of law enforcement, customs officers, and so the cases that are quality of care cases need to be reviewed by a dental person. And so we have our chief investigator, who is a dentist, and then we have the two consultants. So we do use them. They're on a contracted basis. Regarding dental assistants are not on the board because dental assistants are not actually a licensed profession in the state of Oregon. There are some states where they are and some states where they are not. Where we get involved in dental assisting has to do with the radiology certification of those assistants. And we do have dental assistants representation on all the board's committees. They're usually at all of our board meetings, and the board, you know, has a great communication avenue with them. And I think I've lost a couple of the other questions. So.
Is there a bill that authorized volunteer dentists to practice? And the other one was about your unsolicited. You listed as a top priority reduction, eliminating unsolicited copies of the Dental Practice Act.
Right. Regarding the volunteer dentist, dental hygienist, the existing statutes and the existing program exists. What we did and how this program became successful is we sat down with the Oregon Dental Association and the DBIC, the insurance company that deals with malpractice, and the way we were able to do this is the individuals who will get this designation on their license, basically their number will be the same, but they'll get a V added to the license designation so they know that they're a volunteer dentist. They're not allowed to work for remuneration. They must at least do 40 hours a year in volunteer status. DBIC will issue them a different insurance policy at a lesser premium for their malpractice coverage. They still are required to register with the state's registration program that they have for volunteer health care providers. And ODHA or ODA will allow them to take the continuing education courses, which they're required to still complete as a part of their license, and they will do that at no fee. So it's sort of a win-win situation for them. We'll get the opportunity that they're going to give at least 40 hours of time to the citizens of Oregon, and it's not going to cost them any money, but yet the board is still going to have the opportunity to regulate them. If there are issues concerning their practice, the board will still be able to take action if necessary. So we didn't, according to our Assistant Attorney General, we didn't need any further legislative authority. And in regards to the unsolicited code books, Practice Act, that's going to cost me a quarter. We call them code books in Wisconsin. Every time I say that, my staff finds me a quarter, and I'm sure they're listening today, so it's going to cost me a quarter. We still do a number of them where we don't necessarily mail them out, but when we take presentations, we do hand them out. And, you know, we could eliminate that totally, although some people, and I'm sure in your business, as you do a lot with computers, some people still like to have that hard copy every once in a while. And so we have already reduced within our current the number of times we print them, and they're always up to date and available on our website, but we could obviously reduce them more.
Thank you. I'll follow up separately about more information on this volunteer, because I've got a build on doing that doctor's course. Thank you.
Thank you. If you'll stay at the dais, we'll bring up the...
Chair,
do you have a question?
Chair Devlin.
Yes.
Gentlemen, in your governor's budget, it shows a standard inflation personal services cost increase of $59,000 and change, and an increase of $25,000 in state government service charges, pension board contributions, and so forth. That totals out to about $12,000 per employee, or about a $6,000 increase in employee compensation per year. Could you discuss in general, what your employee compensation is as far as, and actually, Chair Devlin, this is something I'm going to ask in phase two of every group. I would like to know what the salary range of their employees are, including benefits. And the other question is, do your people work a 40-hour week, or do they work a 35-hour week, or so forth?
Mr. Chair and Senator Whitson, I'm not sure that I can answer that in specifics because a lot of that information comes to us from the Department of Administrative Services. Most of the employees, with the exception of me, are very long-standing employees with the Board of Dentistry. So, as you can assume, they are at the top of their ranges. I can't give you the specifics regarding the pension issues. We simply get information from the Department of Administrative Services saying, based on your employees, this is the amount of money that we need for the pension bond or we need for the pension payments. And so, I could not give you those specifics. I'd be more than happy to try to provide them for you, but I don't have them off the top of my head. And I'm not sure if maybe Valentina has them or can get them as well.
I would very much appreciate that information.
Okay.
Senator Whitson, we can actually, Ms. Manthey can get that information. Two different items here, though. In terms of, you had mentioned the compensation package, which probably would include PERS and health care and retirement of the bonds, but the DAS, Department of Administrative Services, are separate, and we could find out some more detail on that. But those aren't really part of the compensation package. Those are part of payroll costs, human services costs. And you're looking at one senator that has always been concerned about escalating DAS costs. They never seem to stop escalating.
Well, it's interesting to know how much of that goes to employees and how much of it is administratively tacked on.
Right.
But I think that's something that, that we should know as a committee on, whether we're talking a K-12 or whether we're talking through the thing. We should know what these employees, how they're being compensated, and also on a basis of an hourly basis for how many hours they're working, whereas someone like in K-12, there are some of those folks who work 185 days a year, which means they're off 180 days a year. So, I mean, we ought to really figure that out on the basis of an hourly compensation and get an idea of where the money's going.
Yes. Mr. Chair, I should also apologize. We are all 40-hour employees, all the people, the full-time staff, so I apologize for not answering that.
Since I gave her such a great introduction, could the Department Administrative Analyst, Ms. Flamenco, come forward and give her presentation? I apologize. I've said those comments about Department of Administrative Services in every committee.
And I will be happy to provide more information, and I will try to address at least probably parts of your question. I will be happy to provide more information later. Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee. My name is Valentina Flamenco. I'm with the Personnel Management Division at the Department of Administrative Services. What I'm going to do today is just to give you a very brief overview of the governance recommended budget, and then turn it back to Mr. Bratz for a more detailed discussion. The board's total budget is about $1.7 million total funds. It's included in the Consumer Business Services program area, and within that program area, it's about 0.2% of total spending within the program area. This is a very, very small budget comparatively. In the governor's principled budget, the agency's program is linked to the principle related to health and basic needs. There is only one program area, program unit, operations, and about 58% of total spending happens in personal services. The agency has seven permanent positions, seven full-time equivalent, and the rest of spending happens in 42% is in service and supplies. Over the last several biennia, the board's budget has been slightly growing, and again, a number of positions in FTEs stay the same. And as a part of the governor's recommended budget for 2005-07, the board's service and supplies budget has been reduced by $40,000 in total. That has been done to better align the budget with current spending patterns. It's not supposed to impact service delivery by the agency. And the final slide has information about some policy issues, and Mr. Bratz has already talked about them. I just wanted to emphasize that for the next biennium, there is no quantifiable fiscal impact, although something might change in the future. And with this, I will be happy to take any questions. And I just wanted to start addressing your question about Senator Vitsa, about personal services spending. As a part of the next biennium's budget, the government recommended budget includes a one merit increase, and that basically returns to the pre-2003 budgeting policy. And a significant amount of increase in personal services is about $41,000 for pension obligation bond. These are contributions to bonds to financing for bonds that were issued as a result of the PERS legislation in 2003. This is not specific to this agency. This is something that pretty much all agencies do at this point. And Senator Vitsa, if you have any more questions, I will be happy to address them.
Representative March and then Senator Whitsitt, I'm sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I note that the projected ending balance is $708,000, which represents about 9.86 months of operating expense. Is that a little higher than what we normally like to see in an ending balance?
Mr. Chair, Representative March, DASA's recommendation is to have a 3 month worth of ending balance at the lowest point in the biennium. This ending balance looks, a little bit on the higher end. However, the board's expenses are projected to increase in the future. So soon, this is not going to be a high ending balance in the future.
Thank you,
Senator Whitson.
Thank you, Chair Gilbert. I would still like to see the, and I'm sure you can provide it to us, the compensation package for each of the employees. And where you only have seven employees, it doesn't make any sense to have a range. It's just on the seven. On other issues, you'd like to see a range. But if you could do that, that would include the medical benefits and the first benefits and whatever other benefits they have.
I will be happy to.
Thank you.
The follow-up to that, on page 103 of the budget detail, this only gives the base salary, but there is the base salary for each of the positions. I think what would be necessary to actually provide what Senator Whitsitt has asked for is to have that, plus obviously the inherent costs of Social Security and Medicare, the PERS contribution anticipated, and then the cost of health, dental, and vision care included. We might need to get some sort of presentation sometime during this process on how the pension obligation bonds are basically how the contribution is calculated, as if it's calculated in, I assume it's probably calculated in relation to the employee. But those are separate from PERS now. So, but to see the total cost, you have to see the pension obligation cost also.
Senator Chair Devlin, my understanding is that all DAS-related assessments and include pension obligation bond and other DAS-related issues would be discussed when DAS's budget comes before the subcommittee.
Right. The Department of Administrative Services budget won't come before this committee. Actually, it'll come before the General Government Committee. But in terms of just to see what the actual personnel costs are, we might explore what sort of a sheet we could prepare for each one of these agencies. The other issue that's out there that might be helpful too is to see what which range each position is and what their current step is. That's not actually as huge a request as it sounds, because that's all available. That's normally available data for every position.
We would hope so.
Yes.
Chair Devlin, I would be happy to put it together for you.
Any additional? Ms. Fameko, could I ask if you have you completed your presentation?
Yes. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Could the director and the board member, the vice president, please stay, and we have one item of public testimony you may want to respond.
Okay. Thank you very much.
If you both could please stay also.
Yeah, no, we will.
And then the testimony is a header letter. Susan Violet. Ms. Violet, if you will identify yourself for the record.
I'm Susan Violet from Kaiser, Oregon. Do you need anything more? Is that sufficient? Thank you. Thank you very much for the opportunity to testify today. I hope you'll forgive me. I expect to be slightly nervous. I have never participated in this process before. And I don't like what I feel I need to do today. I wish I did not feel I needed to do this. But I'm here today to voice my concern regarding the Board of Dentistry's performance measures and the Board's lack of accountability to the public it is meant to protect. I have provided written testimony, which contains more information than what I will provide this morning. I'm troubled by the message contained in the Board of Dentistry's choices of performance measures. In particular, the performance measure of completing investigations as far as I can tell, as soon as possible is a concern, because it would appear to encourage staff to reduce the quality of their investigations. And I do not know how this shows the public is being protected. My experience with the board staff's investigations indicate that quality is a problem. The board has an option to provide the complainant the findings used to make their decisions. I requested staff's findings, and it was supplied to me, and I found errors in the facts and assumptions which were not supported by facts. I sent documentation of these errors to the board, and the board has not acknowledged, denied, or addressed these errors. Since staff or the board would not acknowledge the errors, I sought assistance from my legislators and the governor's office. It was reported to me that staff's response was the case is closed, and I should consider obtaining a lawyer. In summary, I would hope, since the board's primary goal is to protect the public from inadequate dental care, that their measures would reflect this goal instead of how fast they can get the job done. And as far as I can tell from my experience, it appears the board believes they are only accountable to themselves, but they are accountable to you during the budget process. And that is all. Thank you.
Any questions?
Just an observation.
Yes.
I mean, you've got 3,500 dentists, I think, someplace in Tesla, 3,200 hygienists. You have 258 case investigations, and obviously this last witness has an issue here, but I'm thinking on the whole big scheme of things, out of all the dental procedures that are provided in the state, there hasn't been a lot of complaints. I mean, evidently she has a real issue here, and I don't know how to resolve that. But in pure numbers, it would seem like basically the board hasn't been doing that bad of a job. Maybe we should address what this woman was talking about. So I don't quite know how to do that.
Mr. Chair?
Yes. Yes, Senator Gordley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you very much, Ms. Violet, for coming forward. While you may have been nervous, you have communicated very clearly your concern. And again, thank you for coming forward. Mr. Chair, I would like to hear a response from the agency.
Yes. Mr. Brands, would you please respond?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm prevented by law by getting into any specifics regarding this case, but I can talk in generalities regarding the procedures that do happen. When a complaint comes in, as I stated earlier, the board must investigate the complaint. And what that usually entails is that, depending on what the complaint is, if it's a quality of care, it would be assigned to one of our dental people, our chief dental investigator. They would communicate with the dentist, request all the records regarding this particular complaint, any subsequent treating or previous treating dentist records. They send us all original records so that there's no chance that we're not getting something we should have. The investigator will prepare a report. He will then bring that dentist, as well as probably that dentist's attorney, in for an interview, as well as even interviewing some of the subsequent dentists. If it's in a very particular specialty, we may consult with one of the specialists that we have on contract. At the conclusion of that report, the investigator will then prepare that report for the board. And once within that 8-week period, we have what's called an evaluators meeting, where two members of the board, the vice president, which is now Dr. Nichols, and another member of the board, along with the investigative staff, sit down and go through all of those reports and come up with a conclusion and a recommendation to the board. That could be as closing the case, as a letter of concern, seeking a consent order, suggesting that the matter go to hearing. If it's of a very serious nature, it could be an immediate suspension of a license. That recommendation is then forwarded to the board, and the board reviews that recommendation, either agrees with the evaluators or disagrees and makes whatever appropriate changes. At that time, the dentist is obviously notified, and so is the complainant. Sometimes the boards make a mistake, or the investigator make a mistake. Maybe there was something missing in the report. Maybe they found out there was another treating dentist that we weren't aware of. At that point, the individual will usually call us or write us and say, "You missed something." And we'll say, "All right, whatever we missed, send it to us. Send us the information. Send us new information, not just a rehash of the old information." That new information comes back in. We will look at it. The investigator will look at it. We'll take it back through the evaluation process and bring it back to the board. If the new information, again, doesn't shed any light on the issue, then the board will concur with this decision. I've been doing a position similar to this for about 14 years, and obviously we know that our healthcare professionals do make mistakes. I mean, that's why they carry malpractice insurance. There are some issues that they can go in and be ready to do something and never realize the result. I mean, they could hit a lingual nerve. It's an acceptable risk. You don't want them to do that. They don't want to do that, but it could happen. That doesn't mean that the Board of Dentistry has to discipline that individual. They may have done everything they could within their powers. There are other recourses. There is the civil court system, obviously, for individuals, and they know that up front. There's peer review. We tell individuals about peer review that exists with the Oregon Dental Association. So I cannot get into the specifics by law regarding this particular case, but I want to assure you that from my standpoint in the years that I've been doing this, I'm not a healthcare professional. And so if I do something, I'm going to err on the side of the public. That just tends to be the way that I do things. And I'm sorry that Ms. Violet did not like the result of the investigation before the board, but I don't know what more that we could possibly do with this particular case. And again, I can't really even get into the specifics. I hope that helps the committee. I'm sorry I can't be more detailed.
Mr. Brands, could you comment on your performance measures? And one of the difficulties I would see, and maybe the committee could keep this as sort of a outstanding issue is that we will have performance measures for all the health licensing boards that come before us, and there's 14 or 15 of them. And one of the difficulties is trying to have a performance measures that deals with complaints because of the issue of how would you actually construct one. If you constructed one that said you will reduce the number of complaints, that would, well, I would hate to say it this way, but that number could be manipulated. If you construct it as the number of founded complaints, which I see in your last year, you had 299 complaints, and 181 of them were either no violation or no further action. 118 were either a letter of concern or discipline, which is a fairly high percentage of founded complaints. But again, that's a number that if we try to basically put in a performance standard, the less that you founded, the better you would look. I'm just trying to, if you'd comment on how you could ever write a performance measure that would deal with this issue.
Well, Mr. Chair, I think it'd be difficult. I don't think you'd really want one of the boards to do a performance measure to, quote, reduce complaints, because I think that would be, as you say, suppressing that issue. I think what you have to look at is I don't think complaints should linger, and I guess I have to give you the best example. When I was in Wisconsin in a similar position, it took 18 months for the complaint to be investigated for it to get to the board. And that's the result of being in an umbrella agency versus having dedicated staff that can work on those complaints. I think what you need to look at, and again, you know, if you were to survey all of the people that the board had complaints filed against them, you'd get a very negative response at some point, because people feel if they're going to complain that something must happen. And as I've alluded to you, and I'm sure Dr. Nichols could add as a practitioner, sometimes things go wrong in a dental procedure. And for no fault of anyone, it just happens. And those are not the kind of issues that I think the Board of Dentistry wants to be disciplining individuals for. They want to be disciplining individuals when there is gross negligence, when there are issues where there needs to be remediation. And that's why, I mean, as far as I know, all of the dentists in this state, as well as a lot of the dental hygienists, carry malpractice insurance for that very reason, so that if something does go wrong, a person does have a recourse to those individuals. So I don't know exactly. I mean, I wasn't here when these performance measures were developed. I've worked with them, and maybe there are. Maybe we need to get some of the health boards together, and we need to talk about some other ways of doing this. But I think from my standpoint, one of the performances is not that we get them done so fast, that we get them done adequately and in an adequate period of time. And when I came on board, there were a number of cases that have been lingering, and I don't think that's good for the consumer. I don't think that's good for the dental person as well. And I think getting them to the board so the board can make a decision is a good measure. And I think we've done a pretty good job of doing it. I don't know that we can get much better than the 2.9 months or 2.5 months. I mean, at some point, you don't want to push it too far, because then you are just simply trying to push the numbers. And I don't think anybody wants us to do that.
Any additional comments from the committee? Yes. Senator Walker, then Senator Gordley.
No, Senator Jensen's had his hand up for a while.
Representative Jensen.
You want to? The other house to go first.
Well, Senator Walker.
Okay, I just have a quick question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Bratz, in Ms. Violet's testimony, she says that a public representative need not be present when decisions are made by the board. Is that true?
Well, the public member is a member of the board. If that member happens to be sick at that particular meeting, the board still meets. I mean, a quorum of the board takes action. The public member gets to see the agenda even if he or she was not there. We did have a short, brief period of time where we had a public member resign, and the governor did not have a replacement, you know, immediately. But in most cases, I can say in my tenure of being there about 18 months, there's somebody usually missing once in a while from a board meeting just because of scheduling. But I don't believe there's a law that says the board can't act if the public member's not there.
Right. You just need a quorum.
You just need a quorum.
All right. Thank you.
Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One of the statements that Ms. Violet has used here is, quote, the case is closed. That would concern me had I been the legislator that contacted the agency and got that kind of a curt answer. So would you help me a little bit with the cases closed?
Sure.
What do you do to close the case, and how is the investigated person involved in that process?
Mr. Chair, Representative Jensen, again, I don't want to get into the very specifics, but I wouldn't tell a legislator simply that a case is closed. I would go into what details I could legally go into regarding the particular matter. When the board does close a case, they have to officially vote to close it for a particular reason. No further action, no violation, a letter of concern, send it to a hearing, etc. And then that information is communicated to the person who has complained. We try to give a brief synopsis. It's one of the things that I've been wrestling with since I came here. When I first came on board, I think we were too elaborate in our responses, so I backed them off a little bit. Then I've got some criticism that there wasn't enough, so now I've sort of gone back to being a little more elaborate, and now I've got some criticism again that it's too much. So I'm not sure that I have found the happy medium yet, but we do the best that we can to communicate. The only thing I can tell you, as being a consumer myself, and I've complained about things in my life, is that there are certain things in people's mind that is what they want as the resolution, and if that doesn't happen, there's nothing going to satisfy them unless that resolution takes place.
I certainly understand that, and probably have been in situations like that myself at times in the years, over the years. Is there any, along the line in this, is there any kind of an appeal? The board is a court of last resort, short of civil court?
Chair Devlin and Representative Jensen, yes. I mean, we always say that individuals, if they have new information, they can provide it to the board, and the board will relook at the case. And in my tenure, there have been some cases that we've relooked at three or four times. And, you know, sometimes the conclusion may change, and sometimes it may not change. But again, I would not give a curt answer to any member of the legislature, any member of the public, if the case is closed. I would review that the case is closed and why it is closed.
We have Representative March.
Thank you, and this is actually back to our earlier presentation about your budget. My sharp-eyed friend to my left here noticed that you have two principal executive manager E's, and could you most agencies would have one, not two.
I'm the board's executive director, and we also have a chief dental investigator and dental director. We have the same classifications. We don't have the same salary, but the ranges obviously are the same. And what you see in here are not the actual salaries, by the way. They are the averages. I think it's very unique to have someone in the profession of dentistry on board. And, I mean, I'll just be as blank as I can. You're not going to find a practicing dentist in the state that's willing to work for about $70,000 full-time. This person happens to be a retired colonel with the United States Air Force. And after he retired and did a little things, went to the coast, he said, this isn't what I want to spend the rest of my life doing. And so he applied for the job that was created at that point and has been there about 15 years. And my belief is, actually, he just turned 65, but he has no intention of retiring at this particular point. My belief would be, if I'm still around and we need to replace him at some point, that's the same kind of person I'd want to look for, someone that has that kind of experience. So, again, how that classification got there, I can't exactly tell you, except that based on his experience, you'd need to pay someone sort of in that area.
Thank you.
Ms. Manthey, what might comment on that? The classification.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, agencies, generally the way it works, agencies will write a position description describing the duties that the position is going to perform, and then the Department of Administrative Services reviews those duties and assigns the appropriate classification within the statewide compensation plan. So the agency doesn't choose the classification. The Department of Administrative Services reviews the position description and assigns the appropriate classification.
Senator Gordley has a question.
Getting back to investigations and how they're conducted within the agency, what are the standards guiding investigations of public complaints? Are there written guidelines, written standards?
We have written procedures as to how we do things. I mean, not specifically as in, you know, the complaint comes in, and I mean we have a standards. I mean, all complaints are treated the same. It doesn't matter whether they're made from the public or we get them from malpractice or the board initiates the complaint. They're all thoroughly investigated. The one bifurcation of that is usually if they are a quality of care issue, they go to a dental professional, versus if they're like a continuing education violation or a late fee violation, they would go to one of our other investigative staff who don't require the dental knowledge.
So there is a policy, standards. There's a policy.
I don't know that I'm understanding. There aren't specific that if the complaint is regarding having hit the lingual nerve, this is what you'll do. No, there's not anything like that. But the standard procedure is that any time it's a complaint regarding quality of care, the matter is we get all the records, we review everything, a report is prepared. The board reviews that report and then makes a decision based on that information.
Is the procedure one that is written? It's a documented procedure.
We have an investigator follows. Yeah, we have a documented procedure as to how the investigation process goes that we share usually when we go out and make public presentations. I don't know if that's what you're looking for.
That is exactly what I'm looking for, and I'd like to see that.
Okay.
That would be very helpful. And then if you could, I think we're getting ready to move on, but in the next, this agency's coming back.
Yes.
With some information that tells us something more about the training and background of the person or persons who conduct the investigations. What's their training?
Well, the quality of care ones are dentists. They are licensed. They're dentists who...
I understand that they're dentists, but what kind of skills and expertise do they have around conducting investigations?
Oh, okay.
That's what I'm trying to get at. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We will close the public hearing on SB 5507, and we will open a public hearing on House Bill 5007, and also simultaneously a hearing on House Bill 5008. Director McTeague, if you would identify yourself for the record.
Chair Devlin, members of the committee, my name is Dave McTeague. I'm Executive Director of the Board of Chiropractic Examiners. Our office is in South Salem in the Morrow Crane Building, co-located with six other professional licensing boards. And appreciate your time this morning. The mission of the Board of Chiropractic Examiners is to benefit the public health and safety, protect and benefit the public health and safety, and promote quality in the chiropractic profession. The board has a strategic plan, and I provided you with an outline of the board strategic plan goals, and we have them into five categories, diversity being the newest portion of our strategic plan. We use the policy governance model for our agency, which I think has improved our efficiency. I don't do the board's job, and they don't do the management job, and the board stays focused on complaints and policy issues. We review a section of the board's strategic plan at every bi-monthly board meeting. They evaluate the agency and executive director performance, and they look at the goals and decide whether they're still appropriate or whether they need changing. An example, a few years ago, out of the board's concern and frustration with sexual misconduct and boundary issues, they added a strategic plan goal that says that will be eliminated in the practice of chiropractic in Oregon, as part of an attempt to send a strong message to the profession that boundary issues were a top concern of the Board of Chiropractic Examiners. We've been in existence since 1915. Currently, our board consists of 5 chiropractic physicians and 2 public members. We expanded the board by 2 members in 1997. We have about 1,200 actively practicing chiropractic physicians. This number has grown about 44% since 1995, if my math is correct. Another 335 have inactive chiropractic licenses, and we also license over 600 certified chiropractic assistants who perform physiotherapies and assist the chiropractor under his or her supervision. We have 4.5 FTE and 5 positions. 2 of our positions are 3/4 time positions. We have a full-time investigator, and our investigator was a private investigator before we hired him in 1998 and had about 25 years of experience in a wide range of investigations and has a tremendous amount of background. So as I was listening to your recent discussion concerning investigations, I thought of him and how much I've learned from this investigator and the previous investigator about investigative techniques and processes. Our legal authority is ORS 684, and there's various other statutes that affect all health licensing boards in terms of how we process complaints. The legislature in 1997 and later in 1999 passed a very strong confidentiality law, and that's what Mr. Bratz was referring to in regards to our ability to disclose details of investigations. However, when we issue a notice of proposed disciplinary action, we summarize the basis for the action, and that is available for public review, as well as when the board then turns and issues a final order or a stipulated final order, then the basis for the board's action is also summarized and available for public review. The more difficult question is cases where the board has not issued a disciplinary action. In most cases, we cannot even acknowledge the existence of those complaints if asked. And if somebody were to come to us with a compelling public reason, then some of that information could be released, but that's never happened, at least not yet. So it's not to say that it won't, but every letter we send out saying this case has been determined insufficient evidence to find a violation, we say, but if you can show us by clear and convincing evidence there's enough of a public reason to disclose more information, we could do that. So there is an avenue available. Our primary program areas are similar to most other health professional licensing boards. Public protection, which includes complaints investigation. We have a 7-member peer review committee, which reviews a smaller number of cases which are more of a clinical nature. When the board says this doctor needs to be interviewed or the complainant needs to be interviewed, we have a 7-member committee that reviews the complaint, conducts the interview, and writes a detailed report, and that goes back to the board for their deliberations. Our Assistant Attorney General is very much involved in our public protection process. Sits in on most all of our executive sessions, offers advice. When a respondent doctor lawyers up, then all the communications have to go through our Assistant Attorney General, of course. The board issues a notice of proposed disciplinary actions, and any subsequent negotiations are primarily conducted by the Assistant Attorney General if the other person has a lawyer. Most of our disciplinary actions are resolved through a dispute resolution process, which is mostly just attorneys talking to attorneys, which seems to work pretty well. You know, the board says, well, we feel strongly about this particular case, and here's our bottom line, and we see if we can come to a negotiated resolution. And most of the time, we are successful in doing that. As you can see from our, in terms of our complaint statistics, I provided you some updated information. I was Friday night, I was going over my numbers, and I found that my 2004 numbers were only there through December 1, so I updated that and found a few other mistakes and reran all my numbers again. So if you wouldn't mind looking at the hot pink version of our complaint statistics, you can see that our total complaint numbers have been, I guess, relatively steady since 2000. We had a jump in complaint numbers that we're reporting from 1998 to 1999, and I would say that is in somewhat due to the Attorney General interpretation of the legislature's confidentiality law that says telephonic complaints are complaints, and we have to process them accordingly. I mean, we still ask telephone complaints to, we try to get a signed written complaint and an authorization for release of patient records so that we can proceed. But we still treat telephone complaints as legitimate complaints, assuming we get enough information to do so. And so that partly accounts for that. But the chiropractic profession seems to have a kind of steady number of issues and that we need to address. And we're not taking licenses particularly. As you can see on the left-hand column under license revoked or surrendered, there have been few, but a frequent response to a serious situation is a period of suspension followed by probation with conditions. Back around 1999, 2000, we had a big case that involved numerous allegations of boundary violations. That investigation kind of, this is what happens sometimes with small licensing board, it just kind of takes over. One case kind of just takes it all. And at the same time, we had a whole bunch of other complaints regarding boundary issues come in. So when we came to the 2001 legislature, we had some problems. We had some real challenges, and we had a complaint backlog that we were dealing with, and we talked to the legislature about that at the time. Now, we've basically worked through those issues, and the number of those kinds of serious complaints and the relative severity has gone down significantly. And we think that's a good sign and a good trend. And we also think it's partly in due to the board taking a strong position, issuing consistent disciplinary actions, communicating consistently with the profession regarding these issues and trying to involve them as much as possible in a dialogue and in a discussion. So those numbers have gone down, and We're close to zero. We think we're getting closer to maybe getting to the point where we have, like, we're carrying a zero number of those cases. Right now we have three open boundary type of cases. I've provided you with an actual listing of our disciplinary actions for 2004 through our recent date, so you can actually see what some of those look like and what the violations look like. A few unlicensed practice cases, violations of continuing education requirements. We had three boundary related cases that we took significant actions on, and we had one doctor who has a substance abuse problem, and we managed to get her out of practice and into treatment. So we don't have a lot of those, but they're time consuming when they do show up.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Mr. McKee, thank you. I was concerned about the sexual misconduct boundary issues, and you've explained those, but can you explain why the unprofessional conduct cases are increasing?
I'm not sure I can.
Can you define that?
Here's two cases we took action on recently that we consider unprofessional conduct. I mean, it might be just a matter of communication. A doctor is kind of snippy with the patient. The patient gets upset and files a complaint. There's lots of communication issues, and sometimes they fall in the unprofessional conduct area. The board just issued a notice of proposed disciplinary action concerning a doctor who tried to borrow significant amounts of money from his patients, which is a major no-no. You should not do that. Doctors aren't supposed to try and get money out of their patients for something other than services. And another case for a doctor was working in another clinic and was taking cash payments from patients and not charting the treatments. And his employer found out about that and turned him into the board. And so those are two examples of what we would call unprofessional conduct that fall into that category.
Mr. Chair, it just seems like there's an awful lot of those. And they seem to be staying pretty consistent in the last 3 years. So either you define those more carefully or you have more practitioners engaging that kind of conduct.
Yeah, I'm happy to take a look at those. I'd have to see a list. You know, I don't have the exact list right in front of me.
Well, if you could bring that back later, I'd
sure.
Thank you.
You bet. So that's just an example of kind of actions we've taken. The board also. We give three state examinations in addition to the five examinations provided by the National Board of Chiropractic Examiners. We have a very flexible continuing education program and a new CE rule that allows doctors a lot of flexibility to determine the kind of continuing education that will benefit them the most. Providing public and professional information and addressing policy and practice questions is an ongoing project for the board. As you can see from the back talk issue that we passed out, we're addressing issue of patient records release and some concerns we've had in that area, and that's going to be on the board's agenda at their next meeting. As part of the board's effort to promote quality, we have a consensus process to update chapters in the educational manual for evidence-based chiropractic. We have a foreword which discusses a lot of the philosophy and evidence-based patient-centered issues in chiropractic, followed by a patient-doctor relationship chapter which addresses a whole range of subjects, and we've distributed that to the profession, and we are currently updating our chapter on record keeping and another one on diagnostic imaging. There's been some controversy in the profession about whether the board should be working on this, but frankly, this is a way that we've been able to have a constructive dialogue within the profession, facilitated by the board, to address a number of issues, looking at the evidence and developing consensus. We are an administrative rulemaking board. Recently, we adopted some administrative rules proposed by the Chiropractic Association of Oregon to give the board some additional tools to address issues of excessive treatment of patients or evaluation of treatment plans that may promote under-treatment of patients. We've outlined the relative percentages in the attached priority listing, which is required for us to provide. We interact with chiropractors, chiropractic assistants, other health professional licensing boards, chiropractic colleges. Our performance measures attempt to address some of the complaint issues that you were just discussing. And we focused on our attempt to resolve our complaints sooner, and we've had some success in that. Our average is overall complaint resolution for 2004 dropped to 159 days, and that's below our target of 180 days. We're still working on trying to resolve our boundary cases as expeditiously as possible. Unfortunately, it's not always an easy thing to do. We'll bring an investigative report to the a board of examiners, and they'll say there's too much going on to dismiss this complaint, but there's not enough information or investigation for us to move forward with any kind of an action. So go out and investigate some more. Well, then there's witnesses we can't find. There's people who won't talk to us. And so sometimes those complaints linger while we try and figure out how to address them. So that's always a balancing act. We don't want to close them too soon, but then we want to do an adequate job to make sure that we can protect the public. It's always a challenge, you know, trying to get folks to come forward and talk. I'm blessed with an investigator who has extraordinary talents at trying to get people to open up and share information. But sometimes it's a slow process and takes a lot of patience. We're trying to measure our efforts to promote rehabilitation as a strategy as opposed to disciplinary actions. Our continuing education program has proven to be more successful than perhaps what we thought it would be when we first made the targets for this performance measure, number four. We're a little bit challenged by performance measure number five. We just completed a survey of all our chiropractors, and there's a report on that in your packets. And we find that we do have some use of these two Oregon-developed practice documents, and as we try to communicate better, that might go up. More people are using our webpage, but our survey showed that most doctors still get their information from our newsletter. So maybe we'll try and produce more newsletters and promote our web page a lot more. And maybe at this point I should...
Okay.
I think that's the end of phase one, but yeah. Having never done this before, I'm not sure.
Yeah, that's the approximate end. For the sake of those committee members that don't know, Mr. McTeague, would you highlight your years of service in the legislature?
I served. I represented Milwaukee in the House from 1985 to 1993.
Mr. Chair, I'm so glad that you did that. I was going to recognize Mr. McTeague's former service. Had the pleasure of serving with you in the House. 1993. It's always good to see.
Thank you, Senator.
Ms. Flamenco.
Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee, Valentina Flamenco, Budget and Management Division, Department of Administrative Services. Again, I'll do just a brief overview of this budget, and you have in front of you a complete copy of my presentation. I will just highlight the most important issues, and then we'll be happy to answer any questions you may have. This budget is also included in the Consumer and Business Services Program area, and it's a total of about $1 million, less than 1% of the total program area spending. Within the Governor's Principles budget, it also is linked to the principle related to health and basic needs of Oregonians. All of the expenditures are covered by other funds, other fund sources, and you have on page four, you have a list of different sources for other funds. And there is only one program within this agency, operations, and most of the agency spending happens in personal services, 57%. 42% is in services and supplies, and about less than 1% is in special payments. And that covers payments to participants in the mentoring program and primarily payments to state police for FBI criminal background checks. Over the last several biennia, again, this budget has been relatively stable, slowly growing, and the number of FTE and number of positions has not changed. There are several policy issues that have budgetary impact. First, the popularity of chiropractic services has increased significantly over the last years. And at the same time, the profession is still developing, it's still evolving, so there's a lot of complex issues that the board has to deal with. In part to address that complexity, there's a policy package in the governor's recommended budget that requests a reclassification for one administrative position that deals with licensing examinations and other complex issues. Further, the board will implement transition to birth month renewal process that will alleviate the requirement for higher ending balance, and that will help the board's their cash flow issues. And finally, the board will implement criminal background checks. There's a substantive legislation going through the process. And there's a policy package requesting expenditure limitation and a fee authority for that for criminal background checks. And at this time, as of March 1st of this year, Oregon State Police has increased their fees for their portion of the checks. So there is a technical adjustment request for the difference. And this is all I had, and I will be happy to take any questions.
Question? Yes, Representative Wisman.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I meant to ask this to the Board of Dentistry. You know, they didn't mention FBI background checks.
Yeah.
Do we have a consistent policy? Do doctors, dentists, chiropractors, everyone have to have a background check? And I was talking to Senator Gordling before the meeting. It seems like we're not consistent in what we're charging and how the state police, and the state police is running this program, you know, are they charging? I've had requests from volunteer organizations to not charge than the FBI or the state police surcharge. So, and this is getting out of, you know, it's something I think we need for the protection of the public, but I think we need to get a handle on it, what's being charged and how it's being run.
Representative Wisman and Ms. Manton may want to comment, but I'll comment also is that the legislature during the 90s added background checks to an enormous number of different occupational specialties. I don't know if they did it uniformly in a sense, but there were so many requests, and they acceded to most of those requests. And in fact, I'm personally aware in terms of a problem that was created in one session because we actually added background checks to salespeople for real estate or real estate agents. And we were running into real difficulties because it was taking a long time to get through the entire process for the background check. So somebody would hire a licensee, and they may not be able, at that time they were having problems where they wouldn't be able to work in the field for 4 or 5 months until the background check would come through. Hmm. We managed to expedite that process, but I don't think anyone has ever done an overarching look at how many occupations we require background checks for and what the impact has been on the state police in terms of those number of background checks. And also, to be honest, something we don't control, how the FBI looks at the merits of their prioritization of those background checks in terms of the other work that they have to do. But Ms. Manthea, if you...
Thanks, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I don't have the background from the 90s. Most of the licensing boards that I have do some level of background checks. Now, whether it's just that the state level through the LED system, and I should know what that stands for.
Law enforcement agencies.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And what you'll see in several of the agencies now, they're coming forward to expand that to a nationwide background check due to the mobility of the professions and tagging it onto public safety. So chiropractic examiners is one of them. Medical examiners for the doctors is also requesting the same thing, as is the Board of Nursing. And I understand, as Ms. Fominka just said, that state police has increased their fee, and now it's currently at $52 a check. It used to be somewhere in the neighborhood of 36.
Right.
Thank you. But as far as a summary of what it looks like, I think as the substantive legislation goes through, perhaps you could comment on that a little bit.
We had a hearing in front of House Health on the three board bills, and all three got moved over to House General Government Committee, and there is a work group, I understand, meeting under their auspices to address the state police's omnibus bill addressing this subject, House Bill 2157. So I think in some of the ACLU concerns, they're trying to address those in the same process. So I believe we're going to be amended into that bill. And hopefully that this will address, look at this from a little bigger picture and trying to sort out the process for how do other local governments get access to these fingerprints or how do other health professional boards get access to this when they need it. Initially, we had to go to the governor's office and get an executive order under the old system to get into the state fingerprint background check, but we don't have the authority yet to get the FBI check, but we need it since many of our applicants come in from out of state and we could miss a significant offender if we don't have that public protection screen.
For the sake of the record, since it's been a number of years since I've worked in this area, but the obvious big difference between simply doing a law enforcement data system check is you're accepting the information given to you by the individual of what their name is, what their social security number is, what their date of birth is, etc. When you do the fingerprint check,
right, good point.
There may be records elsewhere that identify those fingerprints as belonging to someone else, maybe not the person that is applying for the position. So it's actually much more thorough. And I think Senator Gordley might comment, too, in terms of the fee charged by the state police. Senator Gordley and I, and obviously Representative Wisnett, is on the Public Safety Committee, very concerned about the level of staffing for the state police. And, you know, if they're charging more for the fee, it's probably to represent the fact of how many additional items they're having to process, and that might have an impact on staffing for the state police. So, Representative Wisnett.
Thank you. Good information. But I think we should have a consistent policy, and I would be surprised does the Board of Dentistry, do dentists require, if they don't require it, I think they would be one of the professions that should be included too. So maybe. But I think there's enough news reports and things about dentists. I think it's a subject we need to look at, and I appreciate the comments. And I'll be looking at the bill. So it's in HB 2157 is going to standardize it.
Ms. Fomenko, did you have a comment?
Senator Devlin, Representative Wisnett, my understanding is that the Board of Dentistry is already doing FBI and state police checks.
Thank you.
One of the other aspects of this is just to ask for the record, in your experience with this board, which I believe Mr. McTeague has been over a period of at least seven or eight years.
9 years.
9 years. Have you ever found a case where a chiropractor has misrepresented who they are or what their background is in terms of if they've admitted to any law violations?
Yes. I believe there have been a few occasions where people have kind of minimized the extent of their criminal. We ask a question on the application.
Yeah.
You know, we say, have you ever had any previous? And we kind of get these little two-line, well, once I had a little problem, you know. And then we say, well, please send us a copy of the police report and the court action so we can take a look at them. Well, it's a little more than a little problem. And so these things kind of balloon out. We're seeing drug convictions issues for some of the chiropractic assistants who go to work, and so then we have to address that issue and put a condition on their license and make sure that they're not any kind of a threat to patients. A lot of people have been through recovery.
Senator Nelson.
I'm just checking on House Bill
5008 has a $36 background check, but didn't I just hear it's now costing $52? Is there a reason why there's a difference? Or is this, they're going to make it up to the, how is this going to be?
Well, we based that on the old charge, and then the state police went and raised their fees. So
should we be raising this then? Or?
I think what my request to the House General Government Committee is when they do the amendments to give us the authority to set that by administrative rule so it can rise with the actual costs of the state police and the FBI background check seems to make more sense. Of course, then we have to go through your House Bill 333 process, but I guess we can do that. So.
Senator Whitson, did you have a
question? Yes, please.
Yes, Senator Whitson.
Senator Devlin. Mr. McTeague, excuse me, your Attorney General's fees, the Board of Dentistry roughly oversees about 10,000 professionals, and they have an increase of $3,800, and the 16% increase was $3,800 for the Attorney General, which would compute to about $22,000 or $23,000 of total fees to pay to the Attorney General's office, whereas you, in round figures, do 2,200 professionals, and you have a difference of $16,000, which would compute to about $102,000 total that you pay to the Attorney General's office. Could you discuss the difference there?
Well, there was a time when the chiropractic board had a really, really heavy caseload and used a tremendous amount of AG dollars and went to the e-board and got some funding. This was maybe 10 years or so. So ever since then, we've had a higher overall AG budget, and we've had budget analysts kind of take a little bit away. $120,000 came off that one session, and we may be losing a little bit more this session. So we've had a well-funded Attorney General account, but I'll tell you, Representative, in all honestly, I think many of the licensing boards in front of you are really underfunded in Attorney General, because all it could, you know, and it's, that's a good place to carry your reserve too. I want to have enough money in the bank at all times to pay for two full-blown contested case hearings, because if I get a big case and we spend a lot of money, you know, on investigations, expert witnesses, hearings officers, well, you talk to your attorney, assistant attorney general, for an hour, and it costs you $100 or more. You know, it adds up really fast. The big case I mentioned earlier cost us $65,000-$70,000. Just that one case. Well, I'm adding in all the staff time, and attorney time, and hearings officer, and all that. So this biennium, We almost went to hearing just twice, just recently, but you get to like 2 days before the hearing, and then the case settles, and then you can save a lot of money because you didn't have to go through the process from that point forward. But we're probably not going to spend all of our Attorney General allocation this biennium. By a significant amount, and I hope you think that's a good thing, that we're not spending all our money, and I hope that frankly the legislature doesn't set agencies up for a use it or lose it scenario. So I'd like to have enough money in that account to deal with major issues when they come along, and then I'd like a pat on the back when we don't spend it all at the end of the end of the biennium. So that's my plea to the legislature.
You're asking too much.
Maybe.
First, to follow up with Mr. McTeague, how much money have you accumulated in the Attorney General's account?
Well, I believe our budget was $102,000 for this current biennium, and I don't have my projections right in front of me, but I think we're going to spend about 65 of that.
Has that been true over the last, say, 10 years?
It was true. We had something similar last biennium. The biennium before that, we spent almost the entire Attorney General amount. But remember, those fees are going up, too. They're going to go up from 98 to projected, unless you cut them, they're going to go up from 98 to, what is it, 119 or 116? So...
The Attorney General's fees are you referring to?
Yeah, the hourly fee for the Assistant Attorney General.
We've actually set that. Yeah.
Well, they proposed it. You haven't disposed it yet.
I think they've proposed 120, and it will be something short of that.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Any other question for Ms. Valentina? Can we have the same information on the employees of the Board of Chiropractic? I'll get it out to you here. I think it would be interesting, Mr. Chair, to look at the Attorney General's other funds budget, wouldn't it?
Well, actually, the Attorney General's other funds actually make up a very high portion of their budget, because they operate just like the Department of Administrative Services in making assessments to agencies on the basis of their usage for much of their budget. They have proposed, or the governor proposed, a relatively major hourly increase, but I do not believe that the legislature will approve that entire increase. That's probably subject to future debate.
That's been the history over the last few years.
Yeah. We do actually have one person. Yes.
Oh, someone just. I can wait until the person.
Oh, okay. Mr. McTeague, if you'll stay by.
Certainly.
And Ms. Flamenco, thank you very much for your presentation. Dr. Sabo. If you could please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dr. Vern Sable. I'm the current president of the Chiropractic Association of Oregon, and I'll make my comments brief. The Chiropractic Association of Oregon supports this bill and the budget of the Board of Chiropractic Examiners. It's simply a continuation of its commitment to public protection and quality control in our profession, and we would urge your support of their budgetary bill. That completes my testimony.
Dr. Sable. Your testimony then is in support both of their budget bill and their bill that proposes the fee for the background checks.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Any questions for Dr. Sabo? Senator Gordley, you have.
I just wanted to give a pat on the back to Mr. McTeague. One of the things we will be looking at in all of the health licensing board reports is a compliance report on Senate Bill 786, which was passed by the 2001 legislature following a report issued by the Governor's Racial and Ethnic Health Task Force. And it that bill required health professional licensing boards to establish programs to increase representation of people of color and bilingual people on the boards and in the professions they regulate, and to maintain records on the racial and ethnic makeup of participants and licensees. And I'm reading from the summer edition, Back Talk, Back Page Back Talk, from the Board of Chiropractic Examiners newsletter. We heard testimony from Mr. McTeague sharing with us that most of their constituents receive information about the board's work from the newsletter. They use the website, but most are getting their information from the newsletter. So I just want to say that it is encouraging to see that in your summer 2004 edition, you had a back page devoted to the topic, diversity and chiropractic current status. This is an agency that's clearly being proactive and that is actively seeking diversity on its board and in the profession. We did receive some information from the previous agency, the Board of Dentistry, but I think the way that the chiropractic agency is going about it is, it's just right. It's aggressive, and it's putting the information out there to the constituency in a way that says, we need your help to get this job done, and I appreciate the way that you've included this in your report.
Any additional questions from the committee? With that, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 5007 and on House Bill 5008. For the sake of just information, next week we will be back up with more licensing board bills. We will probably bring back the chiropractic examiners next week for a work session. I'm going to delay by 2 weeks bringing back the Board of Dentistry, just in case there are any questions from the committee, to give you more time to see if there are any questions. And there seem to be more debate about the Board of Dentistry than about the chiropractors. So if you have any concerns or you need additional information, we will get the information that Senator Whitsett requested. But please communicate it to Ms. Manthey by Thursday of this week on either of the items. But we will now plan on the Board of Chiropractors coming back for a work session next Monday and the Board of Dentistry coming back 2 weeks from today. Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Really briefly, I think I figured out what we have here, but maybe the committee person would like to tell us, is this what we're going to get on all the agencies during phase two, this data that we have in our books? This was new on our desk today.
Yes.
What?
This is the governor's recommended budget document, and I think you had very early on, I think Sheila Baker walked through what was included in the, no? Okay.
I think we've had like, this has got all the personnel documents, and mm-hmm. as my friend over here pointed out, this is 2 years salary and some of the stuff that's, and PIC personnel information, what?
Personnel information PICS, personnel information control system.
Control system, and then ORBITS is what?
The Oregon Budget Information Tracking System.
Okay.
Which is the statewide budget system, and all agencies enter into it, and then these are standard reports that get generated for each agency, tracking through the components that build up to the governor's recommended budget.
About the policy packages, what do we need to concern ourselves with that? Is that...
The analyst will make recommendations on the policy packages. In fact, she'll make recommendations on the entire budget during the work session. And we will have your recommendations before the...
Yes, sir.
Yes, before the work session.
And Ms. Bominka walked through some of the Board of Chiropractic Examiners policy packages. And these are generally things that they need to invest in, usually their program enhancements above and beyond. I know I'm not supposed to say, you know, essential budget level, but I don't know what else to call it. Basically, their base budget. And in their case, it was the fingerprinting authority. They have a reclassification request of one of their positions. And then the Department of Administrative Services took a small reduction for smart buy savings. And
we will vote on each of these policy packages as a committee?
That, if you
yes.
That's your group, yes.
Yes. Anything additional? Also for the committee, tomorrow we will have a public hearing on the Oregon Department of Education and the State School Fund. I do anticipate that there will be a lot of people here, so we will be limiting testimony to 3 minutes per participant, depending upon the number of people here. If only 10 people show up, we will not do that. But if we have 50 people in the audience, we will do that.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
May I suggest that we hear from the public first, as opposed to hearing legislators first?
Senator Gordley, in the issue of legislators, I will have to make some judgment relative to that, but the normal process in this building is to allow legislators to testify first. In the issue of agencies that come forward or school districts, I will probably try to alternate between official representatives of school districts and members of the public. But it's been the normal practice in this building to allow legislators to testify first.
Mr. Chair, I understand the normal practice. I'm asking that the members of the public be allowed to testify first, since we'll be able to hear from legislators at any time.
Okay.
That's my request.
Your request
I'm strongly encouraging
yeah.
that we hear from the public first.
Senator Gorley, I understand your request, and hopefully
people that are interested in the legislature, that are members and testifying, will understand, and I will try to make that case to them tomorrow, that they have plenty of opportunity to communicate to all of us what their levels of concern are and what their issues are, and that as much time as possible will be reserved. And I'll take this issue up actually before tomorrow morning, should we run into an issue with the President of the Senate, so that we don't get ourselves sideways.
I appreciate it.
We might need to vote someplace.
Yeah. With that, we are adjourned till tomorrow morning.
Thank you.